Okay, this time we'll take your phone calls with Stephen Brody and also your questions right here on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. Stephen, why do you say that we need to be very careful about interpreting cases of precognition?
Well, it looks, when you look at a case of precognition, it looks as if something in the future is causing something in the past. So if I were to have a precognitive dream of a plane crash, one way of understanding that, and the way a lot of people understand that, is that tomorrow's plane crash actually caused my earlier dream. Now, not just philosophers, but a number of people have problems with the idea of causation working backwards in time. And there really are other options, which aren't necessarily more encouraging, but they raise different problems. And it's what Jewel Eisenbud used to call the active analysis. So the other options are these. One is what you could call psi-mediated inference. Let me explain. So suppose I'm an engineer, for example, and I'm examining a building that's under construction. And I go into the building, I look around, I look at the blueprints, and then I go home and take a nap, and I dream about the building collapsing. And I wake up and I say, wow, the building is going to collapse. Now, we might say that what happened there was that all the information I had taken in normally about the construction of the building, the design of the building, and so on, were simmering under the surface and bubbled up in the form of a dream about what would happen. It's a kind of prediction about what would happen based on the information that was gained normally. Now, suppose that what happens in the precognition or apparent precognition cases is that the person is doing a kind of psychic scanning of the environment and gets information about the mental state of the flight crew or the pilot or something like that, or maybe the physical condition of the plane, and that simmers under the surface and bubbles up in the form of a dream. So that would be a kind of psi-mediated inference about the future. It's not really tomorrow's plane crash causing the earlier dream. It's the case of just making a prediction. That's one possibility. The other possibility, in some ways even more intimidating, is the idea that we actually bring about the dream, bring about the future event, sorry. So there you need to do a little psychological digging to figure out why that might be the case. But one reason would be that it's much easier to cause future events when you can dissociate yourself from being the cause. So suppose, for example, that I'm angry at my mother, and suppose I even have homicidal feelings toward my mother, but I wouldn't really kill my mother, but I wouldn't mind killing somebody who stands in symbolically for my mother. So suppose somebody who resembles my mother or has my mother's initials or something like that is on a plane that's in the air, and I discover that psychically, and I make the plane crash. And it doesn't require any massive amount of psychic functioning to do that. It just requires a psychokinetic tweak in the right place, or maybe a telepathic influence in just the right way to make somebody do something reckless.
Okay.
These are all possibilities.
Well done. Let's go to the phones. We'll go to Great Falls, Montana. Brian, west of the Rockies, welcome to the program. Hi, Brian.
Thanks, George.
Sure thing.
Stephen, a fantastic Hi. Program. I just recently returned to Great Falls. I'd been living away. I came to Great Falls 23 years ago from Southern California to work as an artist, and I took out a room at a hotel, a famous hotel called the Rainbow. And there was only three people that lived there then. There was a man who was 93, 94 years old, a 70-year-old woman, and then myself. And the manager said that the older gentleman would probably lecture me, and the woman would want me to do what she wanted. But I got along fine with them. And the man finally mellowed out. I lived there for 3 years, and I returned on his 100th birthday. And I penned a short story called Rooming with the World's Oldest Man. Well, I'm here in Great Falls. I came up here 2 months ago, commissioned by the company that owns the Rainbow Hotel, which is a retirement villa, to paint his portrait. He was 114. And this was, I took about 24 pictures of him, and we talked the whole time. And I asked him questions, and he remembered me, most of our conversations. And he got my old suite, which was large, and he said they could get around in there much better. And he was entertaining a lot of news people at this time. And his last remark is that life is like a school. And he said, just like yourself. I began his portrait, and he died about 10 days later. He died on April 14th. I took a workspace in downtown Great Falls in a shop that was formerly called Karma. And my rent ran out. And the manager at the Rainbow said, well, you can come and we have a lot of space here. You can complete the portrait. And I told her, I said, yeah, I lived there in the late 80s, early 90s. And so I was over there the other day, and these young people, they don't even, you know, they were just kids then. They don't, I didn't know them from Adam. And they were going to give me a room that faced west. And I said, that's just, it's the wrong kind of light. I would really like northern lighting. And so the maintenance lady gave me a key, and she put it in my hand, and it was my old key from 20 years ago. And the key had come back. And she says, well, the suite is easy to get to. She says, you just go up the back stairs by the soda shop, which used to be the bar when I lived there. And I said, I know. And I walked up, and it was the world's oldest man's apartment that they were dismantling and pulling the carpet out. His name was Walter Bruning. And I turned my old key in the door, and I walked in, and here I am in my old apartment where I had great success in those days and where the world's oldest man lived for 16, 17 years. And now I'm back here doing his portrait. And all this was, I couldn't have arranged for these. And I just wondered, who's pulling these strings?
Maybe we're pulling it ourselves, Stephen. What do you think?
I actually do believe that, and it's similar to what I think about what people often call synchronicities, you know, meaningful but apparently non-cause coincidences. I mean, I think, you know, we were talking earlier in the show about what the natural history of psychic functioning would be, and one of my intuitions about this is that it's the kind of thing that we would call on, presumably unconsciously, to when we're fortunate enough to be able to do it, to make events turn out in ways both positive and negative that we would like. It's why I've often suggested that paranormal researchers should spend a lot of time examining people who are unusually lucky or unlucky if they want to find out what the natural history of psychic functioning is.
Interesting. Okay, next up we go to a first-time caller, Kim in Manhattan, New York.
My God, I can't believe I'm on with you. I'm a huge fan.
You made it. Hi, Kim.
I've been trying to tell you this story for years, George, and I can never get through. I basically started listening to your show, and I listen to you every night because of this incident that happened to me that I'm about to tell you.
Okay.
And I'm definitely eager to see what your guest has to say. So I'm trying to be quick. I know you have other callers. It's 2001, and I have a dream that I receive a plane ticket in the mail that departs at 11:11 p.m., and I board the plane, and the seats are orange and red, and I don't know what I'm even doing on the plane, and I'm with all these people I don't know. And we depart, and suddenly the plane is having problems, and in my dream head, you know, I think it's going to crash. And so I brace for impact, and then the next part of the dream, I find myself in England, and I'm floating. I have this floating sensation. I'm in this pristine, historic, beautifully kept graveyard in England, and I have this floating sensation as I'm moving through it. And then I wake up, and I wake my boyfriend up, and I, you know, I'm yelling, and I'm thinking I'm, you know, having a premonition that I'm going to die in a plane crash. And, of course, since I'm all hyped up from the dream, I'm telling my boyfriend every single detail of the dream. Now, fast forward 5 years, I decide to return to school, and I'm in college. And I don't even, at this point, remember that dream. It's just gone from my memory.
Sure.
And I have an opportunity to do a study abroad at Cambridge University. And I get my plane ticket in the mail, and we're talking real life now. And it departs at 11:11 p.m.
Uh-oh.
And as soon as I looked at the plane ticket, I remembered the dream. It came flooding back into my head. So, you know, then I spent like a couple of weeks where I'm terrified. I don't know if I'm even going, blah, blah, blah. And I ultimately determined that would be really crazy to pass up an opportunity like that. And I go. I get on the plane, and all the seats are orange and red.
Oh.
And, of course, then I'm literally walking off the plane. I'm telling my dean I don't think I want to go. And he's like, what's the matter with you? Come sit down. So then I, you know, we land safely in England.
And you're not, and you can't create a commotion, so you got to do it quietly, right?
Exactly. I was literally on that plane convinced that I was going down. But needless to say, we land safely in England. About a week and a half into my trip, a buddy of mine and I decide to rent bicycles and purposely get ourselves lost just to explore the community. And we see a little stone archway, and it's very small. And, you know, he says, let's go in there and see what's in there. We ride our bicycles in, and there's the graveyard. Like, I can literally describe every detail of it as I'm moving through it. And as I start pedaling through it, I at one point stop pedaling, and I suddenly realize that the floating sensation that I had in my dream was exactly what I felt on the bicycle. And I have no explanation for this. And, I mean, I searched every headstone for my last name. You know, I mean, I was really just boggled, and I will be for the rest of my life because I have no explanation for this whatsoever.
So everything almost came true other than the plane crash.
Well, in the dream, the plane didn't crash. I felt as though it was going to, and I braced for impact. And then it just went to the immediately, like a cutscene, it went straight to the graveyard.
Okay.
But, I mean, I can tell you with absolute certainty that I was in the graveyard that I dreamt of. And, you know, on a trip to England with people I didn't know. And I even had a witness to, you know, the dream. My boyfriend at the time, you know, I actually called him before I got on the plane to go to England on this study abroad to tell him, do you remember that dream I woke up, you know, years
That's
ago?
Weird.
Yeah, it was very weird.
Yet
so I just wonder what
that,
you make of it.
On that real plane flight, were you prepared for a crash at any point?
Oh my God. Like the whole time my friends were trying to talk to me, and I'd really not done a lot of flying, so I was already scared as it was. But the whole entire time I was convinced that we were going to crash. And I just said to myself, well, what am I going to do now? I'm up in the air
Jeez.
Now. There's nothing I can do.
I'd say, would you get me a couple of those little wines, please, or something?
Yeah. And then, of course, the whole trip there in the back of my head, even though I really enjoyed myself and was able to get it off of my mind, you know, on the return flight home, I was like, okay, well, this is where we're going to crash, you know? But no, there was no crash, but there was just this psychic dream that, I mean, right down to the departure time of the plane.
No, I would call this, Kim, a precognitive dream. How about you, Stephen?
I would, too. I mean, that doesn't tell us how best to explain it, whether we do it in terms of backwards causation or psi-mediated inference or whatever. But it's extremely interesting, and it's exactly the reason people take precognition cases seriously. It's a great case.
What if there are parallel universes that echo what we do? Maybe some are behind us, maybe some they're in, you know, into time, into the future. And somehow in a dream state, we tap into one or the other. And in her particular case, she tapped into a universe that had the future and she saw it. Is that possible?
Wow. Well, I can't say it's impossible, but it's one I don't fully understand. But I know a lot of people say things like that, and I remain open to it. But I wouldn't know what to say.
I mean, if you believe in the multiverse theory, who knows what's going on there?
Right, if you believe in the multiverse theory. Yeah. I don't know that I do. But I don't know that I don't either. So there you are.
Next up, Norma Jean in California, west of the Rockies. Hi, Norma Jean.
Yeah, it's Norma Jean from Capitola.
Capitola.
Yes. Well, I was hoping maybe sometime I could meet with our guest and have him investigate me. I've been having psychic experiences just about all my life. My grandmother and mother were psychics and spiritualists. But I got hit by a car recently, and I'm getting more, you know, right on in my psychic abilities. I mean, predicting that, I'm seeing that I'm sick and getting something happening, and now the doctors are finding out what I dreamt that I had 4 months ago. And I had things where I'm in parallel universes. I go back and forth in time. And I go to, I've been to not Mars. Let's see. Oh, it's the pretty one with the rainbow color.
Saturn, of course.
And so I just was hoping. I mean, I predicted a lot of things. Like what the biggest prediction I hit on, and I didn't say it was 10 years ago, 12 years ago, when Scott Peterson and Modesto killed his wife. And I had a dream that, you know, when they were doing predictions, that he tossed her overboard. But I was too embarrassed to talk about it, because at the time they thought he was really, you know, a good guy.
Huh.
And then I'm hoping to sort of talk with Marilyn here. I guess it's going to be her birthday maybe this Sunday or this week. Marilyn Monroe, who has my name, or I have her name.
Well, I've lost track of her, that's
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, because she did come to me through a psychic meeting that I had with more advanced psychics, so I didn't speak up too much, but she did come through enough to say that it was not suicide.
So you're convinced you have this gift, Norma?
Yes, and I see spirits, and I really would love to do your Long Beach thing, because when my husband and I went down there, you know, we went on the ship down there, and
the
I
Queen
saw
Mary,
the spirits
yeah.
running around there, down at the ship down at Long Beach.
Stephen, what do you tell people who have these abilities, and they question how they get them?
Well, I tell them they should take it seriously and be happy that they've got the gift that they have.
You shouldn't have to hide it?
You shouldn't have to, but, I mean, the grubby realities of life are that you better be careful who you mention it to.
Well, that's true. We look at, for example, John Mack. You heard his name, psychiatrist
sure.
from Harvard University. He's dead, died tragically in England. He stepped off a curb and some drunk hit him. And he's gone, but he had to be careful in the beginning. He was under a lot of intense ridicule from his colleagues because of his work. I mean, here was this Harvard professor dealing with alien abductions and cases like that, and I think they scoffed him.
Well, of course, and, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I and plenty of others have had similar experiences in the academic community. But, I mean, even if you're not in the academic community, there are enough people out there who would just as soon ridicule you for your gifts, whether they're psychic or other kinds of gifts. So my general life advice is choose your friends carefully.
And watch your enemies, Stephen.
Yeah.
As we say, where do you get the book, The Gold Leaf Lady? Is it still available?
Oh, yes, it's still available. I mean, it's available online. If you go to jazzphilosopher.com or my university website, or just go on to Amazon or other online vendors.
That's kind of a witty website name, by the way.
Jazzphilosopher.com?
Yep.
Well, it's an easy-to-remember one. And
it sure is, and it's you.
Well, yeah, it has to do with the two main sides of my character, right?
How long have you played the piano?
Since I was two.
Really? Really?
So longer than I've been a philosopher.
Who got you going into that? Mother, father?
Well, yeah, I come from a musical family, so I picked it up myself. I just started playing at the age of two.
Did you ever take lessons later?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I had some serious musical training, but I also wanted a job I couldn't get fired from.
Well, that's pretty good. Stephen, stay with us. We're going to come back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take final phone calls with you, and those of you who are on hold, don't lose your place in line. We'll be right back with you on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us with stories of high strangeness, so make sure you're part of that program. When we come back, we'll take final phone calls with Stephen Brody right here on Coast to Coast AM. So exactly what's your topic going to be, Stephen, when you address the remote viewers conference in Vegas?
I'll be talking about psychic functioning and the nature of human abilities.
Take a little question here and there from the audience?
Yeah, I hope so.
You do that? Good. Let's go to Terry in Covington, Kentucky. Welcome to the program. Hi, Terry.
Yes, hello.
Hey, welcome.
Hi, how you doing? I believe that I'm have you heard of Bob Mackie's bar in Wilder?
What's that?
Bobby Mackey's and Walter.
I have not.
Walter. Well, it's a bar that's haunted in Newport, Kentucky, and it is the biggest trial with Pearl Bryan. And she was pregnant, murdered by two cowboys in the 1800s.
Okay.
Wow. I have hundreds of coincidences, synchronicities. I believe in the universe, anything's possible. It's just common sense. But I have hundreds. Even today's date and even the program tonight connects in every way. Numbers, dates, names, with me being an abortion that was murdered to a Pearl Bryan in 1896.
Okay, I don't seem to follow you though. What are you asking here, Ter?
Well, it's connected to a past life with reincarnation and synchronicity that keeps connecting to this, and I haven't talked to anyone about it.
All right.
And I had someone find me a medium, and his name was James.
Well, that's what you got to do. You got to find the right medium and somebody that can help you. Now, Stephen, that brings up an interesting question. What do people do? Where do they find people to help them? Like you said, you're not in the Yellow Pages.
No, I wish I knew how to give a really useful answer to that. I mean, I guess one thing to do is to check with others about whom they have found who has turned out to be reliable, and also read the literature and find out if there's somebody who's been well-tested or certified. Check with the Winbridge Institute, for example, in Arizona, and see if there are some certified mediums that they would recommend.
Okay, let's go to Asheville, North Carolina. Hi, Tina. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hey, go ahead.
Hey, can you guys hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Okay, George and Steve, I believe I'm talking to two professors here tonight. Professor Nuri and Professor Boddy, is it Bob?
Browdy, rhymes with howdy.
Browdy, I'm sorry.
It's all right.
Well, I think, you know, you are so articulate and so conscientious and cautious in your research and your following your, you know, your passion. And then I looked at your website and I saw you at the piano and I heard you play and I've been hearing your voice. And I really think that you need to express another area of your creativity and you need to sing, from what I'm picking up from your voice. Okay. I just had to throw that before I forgot. Okay. But my question is about walk-ins. About walk-ins.
You mean drop-ins?
Drop-ins, walk-ins, drop-ins.
No, walk-ins. And I thought maybe since you had mentioned
it. Oh, you mean walk-ins into somebody's body, you mean?
Yes, because I emailed with a woman who I think she was the author of, and I just sent this to you, George, in an email. I think she wrote We Are the Nibiruans, and she was a walk-in, and that was the first time I'd ever, you know, heard about this. And it raised so many questions, but I got into so many other areas of my own research that I never really went back to that. So do you guys know anything about walk-ins, especially you, Steve?
Not really. So maybe you can enlighten me just a little bit. But if you do mean somebody walking into another person's body.
Yeah, it's like a possession. Exactly.
But really, this woman, like the other woman had died, but she walked into her life and then had a whole different family from another life.
Sure. There are a number of well-known cases like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Where would I research that?
Well, look at the parapsychological literature on possession, for example. The Mary Reynolds case is one of the most famous.
Yeah, but possession, and she walked into this. This woman died, left, and then she took over her life. So it wasn't like a possession, though. You know what I mean? It was like the woman died. Yeah, I know. It's kind of like not big.
What do you mean the woman died?
Yeah, that's the thing. I can't remember now. This was back in 2003. And she mentioned that, I know. It was not like she killed her or anything like that. That's the thing that intrigued me, that she took over her life. But,
the living person took over the life of the...
Dead person?
Yeah. And the woman didn't like her life.
You mean she stole her identity?
No, it's... Okay.
I'm confused.
I didn't research it enough. But okay, I'm trying to remember. I mean, I'm going back to 2003, you know, when she emailed me and I read the intro to this book.
Well, let's go back. Let's go back a little bit.
Okay, we are the
there was a woman and she died, right?
She died.
Who took over her life?
The author took over her life.
The author of the book...
Of the book years later. I mean, this woman lived through the rest of her life, and then she raised her children, and she, like, woke up one day, and she's, like, in this other life, this other body.
Well, that is like the Mary Reynolds case.
Is it? So, oh, yep. How is it like the Mary Reynolds case? Okay.
Well, there was this woman. Boy, it's been a while since I've looked at the details, but as I recall it, this woman got very sick, and when she woke up, she seemed to be somebody else.
Somebody else. Different personality, different voice maybe.
Yeah.
All kinds of things changed.
And remembered the family and actually went to live with the deceased person's family for a while.
So this does this happen often?
I don't think so. Just enough for it to be interesting.
You've heard of some cases where people will wake up from a coma or something and they start speaking in a different language.
Well, apparently they start speaking in a different language. I'm not sure these are all that well documented. The cases of xenoglossy or speaking unlearned languages aren't, as, in my opinion, quite as compelling as people would like them to be.
Let's go to Las Vegas. You're going to be there soon, west of the Rockies. Hey, James, go ahead.
Hey, George. Good talking to you. I've been listening to you guys for like 3 months now.
Well, thank you.
I do a night patrol in this one now.
You keep busy down there, let me tell you.
Yeah, keep the panhandlers away.
Yeah. But,
my future home.
I wasn't going to ask a question. I was just going to tell you something that happened to me like 6 years ago.
Sure.
And my grandmother, like the woman said earlier, my grandmother, she was like psychic. I mean, whenever somebody was going to die or something like that, she would have a vision. And then like within a couple hours, somebody, she'd get a phone call and one of her sisters died or something like that, you know, which was kind of strange. But it never happened to me ever. But it was back 2005. My daughter was born on October 10th, 2005. And I took her back to Michigan she was 3 weeks old, and, you know, so my parents could see her. And my dad, he was retired, living up north, and he'd been depressed for a long time. I don't know why. He just kind of like lost interest in life and everything. And so I take her back there, and like after like the second day I was there, I went to sleep in my mother's bed, and I had the worst dream I've ever had in my life. It was like the whole earth was scorched. I was like walking through the cemetery. There was dead people all around me, walking around me and stuff, and it was in color. I mean, it was real vivid. And it's like I couldn't wake up from this dream. For some reason, I mean, it was just a really messed up dream. They weren't bothering me, the zombies or whatever they weren't bothering me at all. But they were just all around me, and I just couldn't get out of this dream. And so finally when I woke up, I ran out into the living room. My wife, she was asleep in a recliner out there and stuff, and I woke her up, and I told her, I said, don't ever let me go to sleep in that bed by myself ever again, you know. I said, I just had the most messed up dream, and I thought for what it was, you know, like this guy's talking about zombie apocalypse or something like that. That's what I kind of thought. I'm like, oh, my God, what is, like, something like that's going to happen? Well, so then after a few more days, we came back to Las Vegas, and this just happened just a few weeks, 3 weeks later. It was January 1st, 2006. My dad, it was like around noon, he just pulled out his gun, and he shot my mom in the head, and then shot himself.
Whoa.
So I was like, wow, that's what the dream was. It was like death was coming, you know?
Who would know?
Yeah, that was just, it's just the weirdest thing that he just totally wasted all everything that they ever worked for that, to do that. But, I mean, my dream, I actually realized what the dream was. It was that death.
Once that happened,
you know?
Sure. So how do you interpret this?
All
right, thank you, James. How do you interpret stuff like this, Stephen? That's the thing. People get these feelings, they get these hunches, but they miss them.
Well, I mean, from the description he gave of the dream, it's not clear to me that it had to do with the very tragic thing that happened in his family shortly thereafter. I mean, dreaming about scorched earth in Las Vegas isn't all that strange. But in general, you know, unless you're really on the lookout for the right kind of symbolism, it's very easy to miss this sort of thing. It's the kind of thing you might only know after the fact. But that doesn't make it any less legitimate. Sometimes you just need to see the whole picture to put the various pieces
together. But a lot of people need to interpret whatever's happening to them, and they don't. Like intuition, you know, sometimes it's there, and they just don't recognize it.
Sure, and it's hard.
It is hard.
That's why you may not realize what was going on until
the later event occurs. And so I definitely believe, James, that the dream was symbolic of this horrible thing that happened to him later. But how could he have known that at the time?
We'll take a few more calls here. Let's go to Linwood, Washington. Sabrina's on Coast to Coast. Hi, Sabrina.
Hello, sir.
Hey, good to have you here. Go ahead.
I was just going to tell you that I always listen to my gut, and I know what's going to happen before it happens.
You've trained yourself to listen to your gut. That's important.
Yes. Well, what happened, the thing that convinced me to always listen to my gut is I didn't feel like getting going for a ride with a friend of mine. He was going to go over to another friend's house, and I said, no, I don't think I'll go, and I don't think you should go either. And he said, oh, come on.
You had one of those feelings, didn't you?
Yeah, and he went, and he died.
Car crash, or what happened?
Car crash, yeah. But I always listen to my gut because it saved me so much. I was born and raised on the south side of Chicago. And down there, it's real easy to die.
Well, it's those big inner cities are very tough. You got to be careful wherever you go. This mechanism that allows us to do it. Here's the question, Stephen: is it inherent in the human body? Is it like that reptilian brain, the amygdala, that kicks in, or is it psychic?
Well, I'm not sure what the difference is.
Is there something that is part of the physical body that gives you that ability to survive by doing these things, or is it totally psychic?
You mean totally non-physical?
Non-physical.
I don't know. I mean, it may be that I think what some people would say is the psychic ability, what we call the psychic ability, is really just some as yet poorly understood part of the physical organism. I'm inclined to think it's a little more interesting than that. But what you're really also raising is the other question about whether it's, this we talked about earlier, whether it's something that is at least latent in every one of us, but maybe not well developed, and maybe only some people know how to control it in a very conspicuous way.
Could be. Hey, when Jim from Las Vegas called, you said my future home. Are you moving there, or did you just mean?
Yes.
Oh, you are.
I am.
That's going to be interesting. So when do you do that?
As soon as my house in Maryland sells.
Good luck there, huh?
Well, no, I live in a good neighborhood.
Well, yeah, but things are tough right now, aren't they?
They are, but I'm fortunate in one of the better areas in the country.
So if houses move, they generally are going to move there, right?
Lots of government jobs here, yeah.
Okay, let's go to Lakeland, Florida. Gordon's with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, Gordon.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, George.
Sure thing.
Steve. I believe that these things do happen, and I have a few experiences that I'd maybe like to tell you sometime. But a lot of us religious people believe in the Bible that it says in Deuteronomy 18, 10 through 12, that although we might be able to contact the dead, we're not supposed to try to do necromancy, is what the King James calls it. And no offense against you, Steve, but you're at least implying that it's okay to do this. And I wanted to, you know, run this by you and find out what you thought about it.
Why is it not okay, Gordon?
Well, the Bible says, okay, in Deuteronomy 18, 10 through 12, that this is one of the forbidden witchcraft things is necromancy. Okay, necromancy, think necrosis, tissue death. It's contact with the dead. And somewhere in Hebrews 9:27, it says that you're appointed once to live, and thereafter, you only get the reincarnation is not real. Now, there's about four reasons I have for believing that the Bible is accurate. There's scientific stuff in the Bible that is just amazing.
Well, let's find out from Steve. Stephen, I've never heard before that it is in the Bible where you can't try to contact the other side.
Well, I'm not a biblical scholar, so I can't comment on that except to say that, two things. First of all, some of the people who seem to be contacting the dead may not actually be doing so, even though they're trying to. And secondly, sometimes it's apparently the dead who contact us, so it's not necessarily something that we set out to do. And as far as I know, there's no injunction in the Bible against the dead doing whatever they want.
I went to a funeral a few years ago from a friend of mine who died in a motorcycle accident. And while we were, you know, at the funeral home, I hate those places, by the way,
Yeah.
You know, you look in at the casket, and you always do wonder. You wonder, you know, is there something on the other side? What is he doing now? It's
sure.
It's strange, but it always crosses your mind. What if there's nothing there?
Well, it's a depressing prospect, and
You know what? That's a key phrase right there. Depressing prospect. I think people need to feel that there's something on the other side, don't you?
Certainly, most people, I believe, do need to feel that. Otherwise, it's not clear what the point is. You can say to them, well, you know, the point is to live the best life while you're alive, but you'd like there to be something more.
Well, good luck in your move to Las Vegas. Good luck
Thank
in
you.
Your retirement. I have a feeling you're going to be just as busy as you've ever been, at
so
least
too.
In this field. And you're now not too far from Los Angeles when you make that move.
Well, not only that, but next time I do the show, I'll be in your time zone, which will make it a whole lot easier.
It is a long one. All right, Stephen, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Stephen Brody's website is jazzphilosopher.com. And, of course, if you want to read the incredible story of the woman who grows brass skin, it's called The Gold Leaf Lady. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.